From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll visit the gravesite of Milwaukee's only known lynching victim and see how the efforts to memorialize him have come full circle. Then, we'll look at the roots of mass incarceration in the U.S. We'll hear from the programmer of Milwaukee Film Festival's Cine Sin Fronteras about how they're celebrating Hispanic Heritage Month.
Cine Sin Fronteras is our program here at Milwaukee Film that seeks to highlight Hispanic, Latinx culture, and it's part of the overall goal of Milwaukee Film to highlight diversity in film and in filmmakers.
Plus, we'll learn about the life and death of Milwaukeean Mildred Fish Hornack.
I think it's a fair statement that she's the only American who played a significant role for being part of the German resistance.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. For more than a century and a half, Milwaukee's only known lynching victim, George Marshall Clark, has laid in an unmarked grave in Forest Home Cemetery. Clark, who was black, was killed in September of 1861 after being accused of a crime he didn't commit. Last week, a headstone was finally placed at his grave. Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski shares more.
On September 6, 1861, 24-year-old George Marshall Clark and another black man, James Shelton, were arrested after an altercation with two white men. The fight ended after Shelton injured the men with a knife. One of the men identified Shelton as his assailant before he died the next day. A white mob stormed the city jail soon after. And as Shelton hid, Clark was abducted and lynched in Milwaukee's Third Ward on September 8th. After his body was cut down, he was taken to Forest Home Cemetery and buried in an unmarked grave in a public lot. 160 years later, the burial site finally has a proper headstone, thanks to the efforts of a local artist and activist, Tyrone Randall Jr., and Forest Home Cemetery.
It kind of stirs me a little bit just to see this many bodies out here that care about the education behind this.
Randall first researched George Marshall Clark in the summer of 2020, along with his partner Adiah Winter, when they were planning on a march to the gravesite. However, when they discovered Clark's grave was unmarked, it became Randall's mission to raise the funds needed to memorialize Clark with a headstone.
It's easy to just act like something doesn't exist if you can't see it. So the fact that it's tangible, like, hey, that's actually there, that actually happened, I can go and I can say, like, that's a body in the ground and that, you know, I think people need to be able to see that.
Randall and Garen Morris, Forest Home Cemetery sales counselor, spoke with me before the ceremony. Morris was there the day Randall was trying to find Clark's burial site. Together, they combed through internment records and physically mapped out where the body laid.
This has been really awesome for us because we started searching for a grave. I knew nothing about the story until we got together. We couldn't find what we were looking for easily by any means. With a lot of effort, we made it happen. And I hate to put it as any grave that finally gets marked makes me feel good. But to know that this is one that has a huge historical value to the community, to this cemetery, and to our peace of mind to know that next time we want to find this, it's going to be easy. And that headstone is just a small piece of telling a story.
Randall and Morris say that it was a stressful process to make sure they could dedicate a headstone in time for the anniversary. Among some of the last-minute changes was the material used, American black granite.
It maybe is even accidental, but American black, it sounds pretty fitting, right, for the situation. So I think that was pretty cool.
Definitely.
Because I didn't know exactly where American black was quarried. Is it's quarried from George Marshall's home state, which was really cool because I thought it was quarried somewhere else. And when she told me that, I was like, that's fitting, very fitting.
Forest Home Cemetery and America's Black Holocaust Museum held a ceremony to unveil Clark's headstone last week. Community leaders, historians, and activists were among those gathered in the cemetery's Victorian garden on a clear afternoon, surrounded by countless trees and headstones large and small. America's Black Holocaust Museum director Dr. Robert Smith says that while it's painful to go over this brutal event, it's important.
The thing about history and telling the truth about history is it brings about a certain amount of understanding and dignity, quite frankly. And so now his story is being told. And so it would hopefully spark some curiosity with especially some of our younger generations to say, what else have we not been told, right? And so until we come to grips with the truth, we need to continue to unearth these things that aren't pretty. They're painful. But there also is always a good feeling after pain, recovery, reconciliation, and healing.
Educator and public historian Reggie Jackson was one of the event speakers.
So often we think of lynching victims as just that, as that moment in their life, as if they had never done anything prior to that moment. We forget who they were before that. Let's think of what we're doing for George Marshall Clark tonight, not being a celebration of the fact that we're acknowledging this lynching, but that we're celebrating his life that was ended by that lynching.
Jackson says Clark was, from all accounts, a well-liked young man in the community. He was learning to become a barber under his father, George, who owned a barbershop in Milwaukee. Jackson also notes that Clark's life intersected with an interesting time in our state's history.
He was born 2 years after the first black person voted in an election in the state of Wisconsin. Joe Oliver voted in 1835. And George Marshall Clark was murdered in this infamous lynching 5 years before the next black person would vote in the state of Wisconsin, Ezekiel Gillespie, in 1866.
Jackson also points that Milwaukee was a city in which abolitionists freed one black man, Joshua Glover, years before the city would lynch a different black man.
Now, can you imagine being a Milwaukeean at that time, being a city that had celebrated a group of citizens who went into Milwaukee to free a black man who had been wrongly jailed in the Milwaukee County Jail, a story that we all celebrate. Yet, just a few years later, a different group broke into that same jail with completely different intentions.
Jackson says Clark's lynching is a stain on Milwaukee's history that isn't widely known.
Students in Milwaukee don't learn the story of George Marshall Clark's lynching. It's time we start teaching all of them that, beginning today. We have to understand that that racial animus that led to the fight and the racial animus that led to the lynching, it's still alive and well today, unfortunately, 160 years later. Take a look around at who's here. Take a look at the diversity of the city of Milwaukee. We need to value the diversity of our community. We need to embrace the diversity of our community so that we can begin to work on not necessarily racial repair and reconciliation, but conversations that lead to racial repair and reconciliation. I know that if George Marshall Clark were here today, he would say something along these lines. I'm really sad that things have not changed as much as they should have in the last 160 years.
Pardeep Singh Kalika of the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee called for justice and healing and for people to reflect on the ways they perpetuate racial injustice today.
It is well understood that our country has its roots and racialized religious and ethnic violence. Our foundational dirt is so soiled and bloodshed that it's a wonder that grass still grows and trees still blossom. But they do, and so do black families. So does black love, and so does black brilliance. But that does not mean that we can ignore black pain nor be absolved of our own responsibility in causing it.
After remarks concluded, participants walked to Section 17 of the cemetery to gather around Clark's gravesite. Tyrone Randall stood behind the headstone, which was covered in an emerald cloth.
I'm emotional. I'm happy, but I'm also at a place where I know that this work's not done. There are a lot more black figures who have done great work who are still left unnoticed. And I think that is something that needs to change. It's something that is important for black kids to have heroes to look up to, especially in this city. I'm just at a loss for words. I'm at a loss for words because I'm happy that this has come to a conclusion for Marshall. And the work's not done, y'all.
The cloth was pulled away, showing a black granite headstone that reads, George Marshall Clark, July 1st, 1837, September 8th, 1861. Dedicated on September 8th, 2021. Lest we forget.
Want to grab him?
The marker was blessed, and each person at the ceremony laid a flower at the headstone, finally paying respect to a man's life taken.
Lift every voice and sing till earth in heaven ring.
For Lake Effect, I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
George Marshall Clark's headstone can be visited at Milwaukee's Forest Home Cemetery in Section 17. Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski brought us this report, and you can find more information at WUWM.com.
Loud as the rolling sea.
As the eras of lynchings and racial terror through Jim Crow laws trickled to an end in the U.S., another system of oppression began to rise. Now more than 2 million people are imprisoned in the U.S. The majority of them are people of color. And although this country has just 4% of the world's population, it accounts for a quarter of the world's prison population. So how did we get here? People point to different pieces of legislation as the main cause for mass incarceration. But researcher Reggie Jackson says it's the result of a complex web of laws and policy decisions that created this issue. Jackson joined me in 2019 to talk about it.
We have to go back to the 1960s, the policies under President Kennedy, President Johnson, and also President Nixon that kind of put the building blocks in place for us to create this massive carceral state that we have right now. And these are things that people just aren't aware of. There's been a lot of work and conversations about mass incarceration. I want people to know more about how the system developed over the course of time, the building blocks to it.
So what were some of the policies coming out of, I think the oldest one you mentioned there was the Kennedy administration, that really gets the ball rolling?
President Kennedy, very early in 1961, started to attack the issue of what was called at that time juvenile delinquency. And so he put pieces in place to begin to involve the police in dealing with so-called juvenile delinquency. And that was really the beginning of creating kind of a space where we adjudicated young people in a way that led to them having a criminal justice record. And then typically people who have contact with the police early on in their lives, who are arrested early on, they're much more likely to end up in prison as adults. And so that was kind of the beginning of the process, this attack on juvenile delinquency that President Kennedy started in 1961.
When we look at juvenile delinquency in particular, you know, we've started to talk about the school to prison pipeline, that kids inside of classrooms will get tickets and end up in the juvenile justice system.
Yeah, you know, people think that it's something recent, but it really isn't recent. This is something that started many years ago and developed laws developed on a federal level and then state levels to really began to create a system that created the school to prison pipeline. There was a law in 1974, the Juvenile Justice Act in 1974, that really played a really important role, because what it did was it began to create a larger database of so-called juvenile delinquency, and it also put procedures in place not only in our criminal justice system, but also in the social network of organizations that were supposed to be there to help people who were dealing with things. And what they did is they intentionally began to collect data on young people who had any contact with the police, whether they were arrested or not. And they created these large databases, and they used those databases and called these young people delinquents, and they started to arrest them for very minor things. But what changed, though, is that there were juvenile delinquents who were black, there were juvenile delinquents who were whites. And what happens is they began to offer these young whites whites access to programming to help them overcome whatever difficulties they were having, and then began to call them just simply troublesome children, whereas the black children ended up being locked up in juvenile facilities. We started to build juvenile prisons around the country in the mid-1970s, and the majority of the people that ended up in those juvenile prisons were black, and whites simply just didn't get sent to those places in large numbers.
You know, we talked about the fact that a lot of children who end up in these systems also end up in the adult prison population. And as we look at similarly the evolution of these policies, how did that track, you know, going from the Kennedy administration moving forward, what are some of the other policies we see?
So Kennedy started, you know, this attack on juvenile delinquency. And then President Johnson started what he called a war on crime. President Nixon continued that war on crime, and then he started a war on drugs that was kind of continued under presidents after that. President Ronald Reagan really, you know, issued this dramatic call for a war on drugs. And so, you know, it was over the course of a lot of different people who were president, even President Ford. President Ford played a really, really big role in creating the mechanism that led to mass incarceration as well. So as we look back on it, and most Americans aren't aware because, you know, we like to look back in the past and point fingers at specific people. But I tell people that it was Republicans as well as Democrats who were in the White House, Republicans and Democrats who were in Congress, who all created these laws on the federal level, and then the same thing on the state level. Republicans and Democrats all played a role in it. So, you know, this whole pushback, the Republicans blaming the Democrats blaming the Republicans, everybody in some way, shape, or form was responsible for certain things that happened. And we don't realize that it took a really long time to create the system. It wasn't just something that happened because Ronald Reagan said we're going to have a war on drugs in, you know, the early 1980s. There were building blocks that were set up before that. I argue this point, Joy, is that you can't fight a war on drugs unless you build an army first. And we have to set up the mechanism to create all of the ways to fund police, court systems, prison building. All of those things took place over a pretty extended period of time. And most people just aren't aware of that history.
When you really start to untangle kind of the web of the war on crime or the war on drugs, these are ultimately a war on people. People commit crimes. Mm-hmm. People do drugs or sell drugs. You talked about the kinds of mechanisms that were set up. What did those look like for the war on crime?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, when President Johnson issued this war on crime, one of the things that made it possible was a piece of legislation that most Americans have never heard of. To me, the most important legislation that led to mass incarceration was the creation and the signing of a bill in 1965 called the Law Enforcement Assistance Act. And what that bill did was it changed the way law enforcement worked in the country permanently. What it did was, for the first time in American history, it allowed the federal government to be able to work in collaboration with local and state law enforcement. Prior to that, there had never been any collaboration. So it basically opened the door for the federal government to be able to give funds to states and local communities for law enforcement to pay for more police officers, to pay for, you know, hardware for the police officers, to pay for building prisons. That was really the turning point in how we did criminal justice. And one of the things that came out of that, if you look at who was in prison in 1950 versus who was in prison in 1970, you know, people talked a lot about the crime rate increasing through the 50s and 60s, right? But what you find, if you look at the data, is that the number of people in prison actually dropped from 1950 to 1970 in almost every state, a pretty significant drop. And one of the primary reasons that it dropped was in the 1940s and the 1950s, they began to have conversations. People started to talk about the use of mandatory minimum sentences, which had been developed years before that, and how unfair those mandatory minimum sentences were for drug crimes. And the arguments were the same that we hear now, that, you know, these mandatory minimums don't work, they're unfair, all those things. The biggest difference, though, was back in the 50s and the early 60s, the people who were arguing to get rid of those mandatory minimums were arguing because too many white men had been sent to prison because of these mandatory minimums. So they literally, at the federal level, got rid of those mandatory minimums, and a lot of people ended up getting out of prison. And so prison population was actually going down
when we started this war on crime instead of the prison population going up. And then it began to explode and accelerate pretty quickly as we put these new laws into place and more punitive measures. We began to really treat crime in a different way. It became law and order. You know, it was a rhetoric that all politicians used who wanted to be elected, whether they be Republicans, Democrats, whatever. All of them used that law and order kind of language. And a part of it was related to the civil unrest that happened in the 1960s, you know, across the country, ignoring what happened, what caused the civil unrest, which was mainly related to, you know, poverty and feeling oppressed in those communities. They use that as kind of a springboard to say, oh, the country is really dangerous. We need to do something about it. We need to lock these people up. And of course, it was coded racial language because people knew when people spoke about law and order that they were really talking about Black people that were, you know, these people that people considered to be the criminals in the country, and ignoring the fact that in 1970, most of the people in prison in the country were actually white.
You're listening to Lake Effect. This is Joy Powers, and I'm speaking with Reggie Jackson about the history of mass incarceration. So as we move into the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, and the war on drugs, a lot of people have compared it to the opioid epidemic that we're continuing to experience and the different ways we've responded to this crisis, specifically how we've treated people with crack cocaine, both people who are dealing it and then, of course, just everyday users. What did the criminalization of drug addicts look like in the 1980s?
Well, you know, we started to create laws in the 1980s under the Reagan administration with the assistance of Congress to fight a war against drugs. And so, you know, one of the things that happens is that over a long period of time, the federal government has criminalized different drugs. So going back to the early 1900s, they, you know, criminalized cocaine, they criminalized marijuana, criminalized heroin, all these things. And those laws have been on the books for a long time. But what happens in the 1980s is this new form of cocaine comes on the scene, called crack cocaine. Now, nobody knew anything about crack cocaine as these laws were being written. You know, the first really important law in the war on drugs on the federal level was in 1986. And then there's another one in 1988. And then, of course, the one in 1994. But what happens is we began to put punishments in place. We began to create mandatory minimum sentences. We began to create sentences that are related not to the way that we did it before. So prior to that, people would be arrested and adjudicated and sent to prison, sentenced based on the drugs that they used. But we began to use quantities to determine how long people would go to prison. And so we had these sentencing guidelines that were written based on the quantities of drugs that people were caught with. We created really a law that was very unfair. Even though a majority of people who used crack cocaine and who sold crack cocaine were white, and that's still the case to this day. 66% of lifetime users of crack are white people. But the laws were implemented in such a way that we ignored crack cocaine users in rural communities, in small towns, in white communities. We just ignored them for the most part because we concentrated all of our efforts on central cities like Milwaukee and Chicago and Detroit and places of that nature. And so what ends up happening, we began to send people to prison using mandatory minimums. And what we did was we said, well, cocaine, powder cocaine and crack cocaine aren't the same. Crack cocaine is way more dangerous. You know, there are all of these stories in Time Magazine and Newsweek about how crack cocaine was, you know, the most dangerous drug ever created. And so it becomes this drug that people become very concerned about. It ends up ruining a lot of people's lives. And there are all of these stories about it. People are talking about it as if they're experts on it. And they don't know anything about it because nobody has done any research on it. It just becomes one of these things where enough people say that it's the most addictive drug known to man. Then everybody begins to believe it, even though it's absolutely untrue. And so it was very easy for people to pass this legislation in 1988, which basically said, if you're caught with 5 grams of crack cocaine, there's a mandatory minimum 5-year prison sentence. which is the only mandatory minimum sentence for the first time you're convicted. There's no other drug in the country at that time that required a mandatory minimum sentence for a first-time offender. And you needed 500 grams of powder cocaine to get the same mandatory five-year sentence. So you literally created a 100-to-1 ratio. And most people were okay with that because they had heard about how dangerous cocaine was, but they thought that crack cocaine was way more dangerous, not understanding that they're the same chemical. And so you began to have a tremendous number of people arrested for crack cocaine offenses. And most of those people arrested were Black. Not only were we arresting people who were selling the drugs, but we were also arresting and incarcerating people who were users. And our prisons began to fill up with people who were drug addicts. And, you know, nowadays we've heard, as you mentioned, the opioid crisis and how many people are addicted to opioids. But we don't see this mass arrests of people who are on opioids. Now we're talking about drug treatment for these people. And so we created a situation where we pointed the finger at the Black and Latino community in particular. And we put all of our efforts into fighting drugs in those communities and ignoring it in other communities, particularly the White community. And those things in the 80s in particular began to lead us to have huge disparities in terms of who was in the prisons. Those are things that people are kind of beginning to admit now. President Clinton apologized for being part of this and other people who signed the law in 1994. But nobody has apologized for the laws in 1988 or 1986 or any of the other ones that I talked to you about. Nobody's apologized for those. Those really created the system that we have. And I think what's left out of the conversation about reform that's happening is that, listen, not only do we have 2.2 million people incarcerated on any given day, we also have over 2 million people who work for the criminal justice system on any given day, anywhere from 2.2 to 2.4 million people, depending on the database you look at. So well over 2 million people that are employed as police officers and judges, court clerks, stenographers, prison guards, probation and parole agents. So it's really a system that is self-perpetuating because it employs over 2 million people. To incarcerate 2 million people, we have 2 million people working in the system to make sure that people are incarcerated.
So when we look at reforming this system, what are the ideas out there and what's actually being implemented?
Well, you know, there's a lot of talk about reform, and there have been a great deal of reform efforts by different states. States are doing different things. So states are getting rid of mandatory minimum sentences. States are getting rid of, like, the three strikes and you're out laws. States are changing the sentencing guidelines for, you know, different crimes. So there's a lot that's being done. Even on the federal level, there have been efforts to change, like, the crack cocaine versus powder cocaine sentencing disparity, which is 100-to-1, has been lowered to 18-to-1. There have been measures on the federal level that have kind of allowed people to get out of prison earlier to kind of backtrack on some of those sentences that were developed in the 80s. But I tell people that those things are slow to happen and that they're not having a huge impact. They are having an impact, though. We are seeing less numbers of Blacks in prison. The number of Blacks, Black men in prison in particular, has been dropping since 2002 when it reached its peak. It's been going down every year since then. The national prison population has decreased primarily because of states like California, which the prisons were so overcrowded that federal judges basically forced them to let people out of prison early because it was just ridiculous overcrowding. So there are efforts that are working. There are a lot of efforts here in Wisconsin to talk about reform. There really hasn't been much reform in Wisconsin. There's been reform in a lot of states. You know, a lot of states are, you know, creating best practices that we could follow as a state, but we're choosing not to. And I tell people who are working on the reform efforts that what they don't understand is that they're fighting against a huge system. We don't have a criminal justice system in the United States, Georgia. We literally have over 3,000 criminal justice systems because every county or county equivalent has their own district attorney and their own system in those counties. Then we have the federal system, and then we have the military system as well. So we have all of these different systems that don't always work well together, and reform in one county doesn't apply to the next county. So I've been telling people here in Wisconsin that when we think of the incarceration of people here, and there are over 23,000 people in our prisons currently, the
effort to reform the system needs to be a statewide effort, but it also needs to be a countywide effort. We need to look at the counties where a majority of the people are coming from and ask, you know, what's driving it in those communities and fight it at that level.
Well, Reggie Jackson, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
You're welcome, Joy.
Reggie Jackson is the co-owner and lead trainer and consultant for Nurturing Diversity Partners here in Milwaukee. We spoke in 2019, and you can find our full conversation at WUWM.com. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we'll learn why the Hone Bridge will be lit up in red tomorrow evening, and the Wisconsin woman who became the only American civilian executed on direct orders from Adolf Hitler. But first, we'll hear from the programmer of Milwaukee Film Festival's Cine Sin Fronteras on how they're celebrating Hispanic Heritage Month. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Today is the first day of Hispanic Heritage Month, a month dedicated to celebrating the histories, cultures, and contributions of those whose ancestors came from Spain, Mexico, the Caribbean, and Central and South America. The Milwaukee Film Festival Cine Sin Fronteras, or Cinema Without Borders, is celebrating all month long with film, food, and music. Every weekend, they'll show films covering topics like the Afro-Latinx experience, immigration and social justice, and Indigenous Peoples Day. Lake Effect's Mallory Chang spoke with Ernie Quiroz, the Cine Sin Fronteras programmer with the Milwaukee Film Festival.
Could you explain a little bit what Cine Sin Fronteras is, and why is it important for the Milwaukee Film Festival this year?
Cine Sin Fronteras is our program here at Milwaukee Film that seeks to highlight Hispanic, Latinx culture through cinema. And it's part of the overall goal of Milwaukee Film to highlight diversity in film and in filmmakers. It's in conjunction with other programs like the Black Lens program, Genre Queer, that really seeks to promote voices that may otherwise go unheard, you know, to give them that platform that we can at Milwaukee Film. You know, I've always felt that besides film, the best way to get to know another culture is through food and music. So we've sort of themed some different events throughout the entire month, obviously around film, but also food and music. And we also have some hybrid, some virtual events. So if for whatever reason you can't make it out to the Oriental Theater, or if you do make it out to the Oriental Theater, there's a lot more other films that will sort of supplement all the other programming that we're doing in person. So it's a mix of different programming and, you know, for different ages. And like our kickoff celebration, it's going to be Friday, September 17th, runs 4 to 8. And actually that's at the Zocalo Food Truck Park. And not going to be any films out there, but it's going to be some food and some music, some Latinx vendors, and just sort of a fun way to start the whole month-long celebration. So that's going to be Friday, September 17th. And then we'll have screenings and events just about every weekend for 5 weekends.
Are all the movies going to be shown at the Oriental Theater? You mentioned some are going to be online too.
Yeah, so there's going to be 5 films that are going to be in person at the Oriental Theater, and then about 10 additional films that are going to be available online. We have the hybrid model for this film series because we know a lot of people can't make it out to the Oriental Theater either. It might be too far to drive, or maybe they don't feel comfortable with COVID. For any number of reasons, we adopted this hybrid model so that people can sort of watch these films at their leisure, at their own terms. You know, and for people that do want to come out, you know, we want to make sure that, you know, we're following all the CDC protocols, the standard protocols, and the social distancing and the masks and vaccinations and all that. So we want to reassure people that if they do come to the in-person events, that they're going to be safe. Each weekend, starting September 15th, we're sort of theming around a different topic. So that first opening weekend is food, because everyone loves food. So we have a food-related film on that weekend. It's called Finding Gaston. It's a film from Peru, and it's about Peruvian cuisine. And we're going to work with Peruvian restaurant to have some food out there at the Oriental Theater. And then weekend two, the theme is music. So we have some music-related documentaries. And then weekend three, we're going to be talking about the Afro-Latinx experience. So we have some films centered around that intersection between African culture and Latinx culture. Then weekend four, we have some social justice documentaries, immigration documentaries. And then weekend five, actually, Indigenous Peoples Day is October 11th. It used to be called Columbus Day. It's now Indigenous Peoples Day. So we're going to end the program with some Indigenous films, Indigenous filmmakers, films by and about Indigenous cultures. So sort of every weekend, we have a different sort of topic and films related to each of those topics.
And of course, the Latinx community is extremely diverse in itself. So I'm really excited to learn more about the different intersections within the community. How were these films chosen to be premiered each week for the festival?
That's a big challenge is, you know, you're talking over 20 different countries in Latin America, Central and South America. You know, each country has their own heritage, has their own culture, you know, their own history and politics, and there's just so many things going on. So to try to encapsulate that in, you know, 15 films is challenging. But there's those definite topics that, you know, that we want to hit. You know, we could easily do a whole slate of films about immigration, you know, but so much of Latinx culture, I mean, it's not just about immigration. There's so many other things. So it's a challenge, but it's something that we want to do year-round, so it's not just this one program. It's the big festival in May. It's year-round programming because these are year-round issues and a year-round celebration of culture. You know, it's a mix of films that are brand new, films that are coming off of the festival circuit. There's films from Sundance and South By. There are some films that we did play in the festival in May, and then we're bringing them back. So if you missed them, we're giving you another opportunity to see those films again. We just try to get a mix of, like I said, you know, there's some films that also are about LGBT experience in Latinx culture. There's films about DACA and Dreamers, different genres, comedy, drama, you know, trying to just have a whole mix of films. And then obviously, you know, there's always great food documentaries, always great music documentaries. So it's great that we were able to find some that also celebrate Latinx culture. And then the Afro-Latinx films was inspired by when the movie In the Heights came out earlier this summer. There was a bit of controversy over the film. It was accused of sort of whitewashing and sort of ignoring the Afro-Latinx experience, you know, of primarily featuring light-skinned Latinos when supposedly these characters were from the Caribbean, from like the Dominican Republic and Haiti. And so we really wanted to have that as a part of the conversation for this film series. So that's going to be weekend three. It's the first weekend of October. We have some films about the Afro-Latinx experience. And we're going to have a panel put together with some of the filmmakers to sort of discuss these issues of what does Blackness mean and what does Blackness mean within the Latinx sort of larger community. So that was something that, you know, it happened over the summer, and it was like, okay, well, here's some films that deal with that. We can put that in the series and sort of talk about this as an issue.
What are you excited about that you want to see this month for Hispanic Heritage Month? What movies, what events are you most excited about?
Obviously, food and music. You know, I love food and music. So those first two weekends, I'm really excited about the film that we have for that opening weekend, Finding Gaston. Like I said, it's about Peruvian cuisine. So we're working with a great Peruvian restaurant. They're going to bring out some empanadas, so that will be fun. And then music. The movie that we have for the second weekend is a documentary called My Name is Lopez, and it's about the artist Trini Lopez, which he was around in like the 50s and 60s, and he was really sort of the first rock and roll star who crossed over into, well, you know, Hispanic audiences with a rock audience, and sort of laid the groundwork like way before Richie Valens and before, you know, even like before Los Lobos and before all those, you know, all those people, he was able to cross over like that. And he's still around, he still performs. So that's really cool. And it's just good, fun rock music from the 50s and 60s. And sort of really cool to see how he was able to break down that door.
Thank you so much, Ernie, for being here on Lake Effect.
Like I said, yeah, thank you so much. Hopefully see you all at the Oriental Theater.
Ernie Quiroz is the Cine Sin Fronteras programmer with the Milwaukee Film Festival. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. Starting today through October 15th, Cine Sin Fronteras will be holding screenings on the big screen at the Oriental Theater, with options to watch movies on your personal screens at home. You can find out more at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll learn about Mildred Fish Harnack, her work as part of the German resistance, and her death by direct order from Adolf Hitler. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
I'd ring it in the morning, I'd ring it in the evening, all over this land.
This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Tomorrow is Mildred Fish Harnack Day here in Wisconsin. And if you don't know who that is, you're not alone. Despite the courageousness of her life's work, fighting the Nazis as a founder of the Red Orchestra resistance group in Germany, much of her story has been lost to time. But her work and her courage remain a potent reminder of the power of people to overcome great evil. And in honor of her life, the Hohen Bridge will be lit in red, perhaps as a nod to the Red Orchestra or to her work for the USSR. Art Heitzer has been an integral part of reviving Fish Harnack's story by lobbying for the state holiday recognizing her life and as the president of the Milwaukee Turners, which is celebrating her in an event this Sunday at Turner Hall. He joins me now to talk about her. Art, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me and for covering this very important story, I think, for the world, but even more so for Milwaukee.
It's an interesting story that I would guess very few people know about. In a couple sentences, just to kind of start off, how would you describe her?
She was a working class, near West Sider in Milwaukee, born 1902, I think, who became quite involved in scholarly matters. She was not of German nor Jewish ancestry, but did become very involved in German culture, married a German scholar that they met together at UW-Madison, and moved there when Hitler was taking over and formed the core group of what's sometimes described as the largest resistance group based in Germany against the Nazi regime.
She has the distinction of being the only American woman to be executed on the direct orders of Adolf Hitler. And I'd like to get back to, you know, why she was considered so dangerous in just a moment. But as you mentioned, she moved to Germany just as the Nazi Party was beginning to rise to power and really re-enter the public consciousness with a more kind of streamlined professional kind of politicking than they had had in the past. How did the views of the Nazis square with Mildred's politics?
Well, we don't know everything about Mildred's politics. She was certainly a progressive of some kind, but she was someone who did not accept injustice. but even more so, she was involved in being a bridge between various cultures, most prominently American and German culture. She was a real scholar, humanist. She married into one, if not the blue chip families of academics in Germany, the Harnacks, in the field of theology, science, and humanism. Her husband was studying under John R. Commons, which is a name that will mean something to people who care about the Wisconsin idea in Madison. And they had a regular group, the Friday Nighters, who would meet and discuss issues like, should there be some kind of compensation for people who are unemployed? And should there be Social Security and workers' comp and all that stuff? So they were scholars, but among many things and among many scholars, they did not accept the intolerance and the brutality and the aggression, the racism, I would say subjugation of female ideology of the Nazis.
How did they come to form what is at least now known as the Red Orchestra?
Yeah, well, let's talk about the Red Orchestra for a minute. So the Gestapo, which was a Nazi foremost police group, I guess we'd say. So they were looking for this group of people who they nicknamed Die Rote Kapelle, generally translated in English as the Red Orchestra. And that consisted of various people, many intellectuals, but also workers and people from different backgrounds, many of them left-wing oriented, but also conservatives. But they were united in their hatred and willingness to take risks, even the ultimate sacrifice, to defeat Hitler and the Nazi power structure.
Ultimately, Mildred Fish Harnack does make that ultimate sacrifice. As previously mentioned, she does have the distinction of being the only American woman to be executed on direct orders from Adolf Hitler. Why was she considered so dangerous?
So actually, I think her claim in that regard is even broader. We don't know of any men, American men, who were in that same situation. And I think it's a fair statement that she's the only American who played a significant role or was executed for being part of the German resistance, male or female or anything else. So she was a very gifted linguist. So the group published an underground newspaper, tried to reach foreign workers that were brought in to work in armaments plants because some of the German guys were already involved in fighting the war itself. She was also very much an intimate of the remaining staff of the U.S. Embassy and legation there, and provided information about Nazi war plans and armaments plans, both to the U.S., but also they provided information to the Soviet Union about the plans of Hitler to break kind of the detente they had on the Eastern Front and to invade. And so they played a crucial role. I mean, she's sometimes viewed as a spy, and that was valid, but was not the beginning or the end of what her role and the whole group did. So she was initially sentenced to 6 years of hard labor. Her husband, Arvid, was sentenced to be executed and was around Christmas of 1942, I believe. And by February of 1943, Hitler was increasingly, I'll say, beside himself as the war in the East against the Soviet Union, which they thought was going to be a big success and a piece of cake, ended up being a disaster. So Hitler was angered, and he had this American in his clutches, so to say, and did not feel that a six-year hard labor sentence, which she would perhaps have survived the war, was justified, and took revenge against the American nation by ordering her execution.
As we look at her legacy today, as it stands, you know, not just here in Milwaukee and Wisconsin, but, you know, nationally as a figure who did fight for German liberation. What do you think that legacy really is?
Well, I think, number one, it's that people can, and some people think they're obligated to take action when they see injustice, whether it's anti-Semitism, whether it's a war of aggression that killed tens of millions of people, whether it's general intolerance or lack of willingness to discuss ideas. And even when the stakes are very high, in this case, as high as they could be for the individuals in that group.
Well, she's getting some recognition now with the lighting of the Hone. I think a lot of people are looking forward to seeing that. Art, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing so much of this story.
Thank you very much.
Art Heitzer is the president of the Milwaukee Turners and an expert on the life of Mildred Fish Harnack. Tomorrow is Mildred Fish Harnack Day here in Wisconsin, and in honor of her memory, the Hone Bridge will be lit red. The Milwaukee Turners will also be hosting an event celebrating her life this Sunday at Turner Hall. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll dive into understanding the data collection of the 2020 census and of Wisconsin's demographic shifts. Plus, we'll hear the latest Listen NKE, all about vaccine hesitance. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect. On listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.